He said his pitch wasn't too fast that night, but it did clear the plate. Forward Tim Thomas and the Chicago Bulls have agreed on a contract buyout ending the veteran's second stint with the Bulls. Acquired from the New York Knicks in February, Thomas averaged 5.8 points and 2.3 rebounds in 18 games with Chicago. He was scheduled to make about $6.4 million next season, but the Bulls had no room for him after drafting forwards James Johnson and Taj Gibson last month. The Indiana Pacers have signed free agent guard Dante Jones. His agent, Aaron Mintz, says the Pacers were planning to make the announcement during a news conference today. He said the four-year deal is worth $11 million. And U.S. Olympic officials, Major League Baseball, and other professional sports organizations are getting into the NFL's fight with two Minnesota Vikings linemen who were suspended for violating the league's anti-doping policy. Major League Baseball, the National Basketball Association, and the National Hockey Association asked yesterday for permission to file paperwork in federal court in support of the NFL, which wants to suspend the players for 4 games. The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency filed a similar motion on its own. The leagues contend their own drug testing programs would be affected if the linemen are allowed to fight their 4-game suspensions in state court. And the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency argues uniform rules are needed to ensure a level playing field. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Blood donation takes only 45 minutes and saves lives. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
It's 2:42. In northern Pakistan, the journey home began yesterday for millions of refugees who fled the army offensive against the Taliban. These refugees have been stuck in camps for months now, but only a few of those who fled the fighting climbed on buses to take them back home. Most of those who left have no idea what they would find when they arrive. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
In the early morning heat and dust of the Jalousai camp, buses line up to take the first group of families, some 149, home to Swat Valley. They are a trickle of the 4,000 families here, most from the mountain and stream-filled valley. Nothing prepared them for this flat-baked spot of 100-plus degree temperatures, a 4-hour drive south of Swat. Overcome at the prospect of leaving, tears streak the face of one woman. She says modesty dictates that she be known simply as the sister of Shokat Ali, her displaced brother. We are very happy to be going back, she says, her face a mixture of grief and relief. I have not spent a single contented day here. May God have mercy on these camp dwellers and guide them home. Life here is nothing but helplessness, she says. The Swat exodus was one of the biggest displacements of people in recent times. Millions fled their homes as government troops took on the Taliban. The turmoil laid bare government ineptitude. But the army says its offensive has dislodged the Taliban from the valley where they once called the shots. For all the misery it caused, SWAT returnee Juma Ghul says the fighting was worth it. It was necessary because these terrorists weren't going to leave without a fight, he says. They were on the march, slitting throats and beheading people. They were terrorizing the population, so the army had to come in and remove them, he says. But none of the Taliban's top leadership has been captured or killed in the 2.5-month-old offensive that the military says is in the mop-up stage. As Berkt Sultan, a widow, prepares to board the bus back to Swat with her 9 children, she says she's not convinced the army has eliminated the militants. We have resigned ourselves to death in returning home. Whether we live or die, we have no other option, she says. Sultan adjusts her white headscarf and skeptically says that returnees have been given their food packages and fans this day because officials have come to visit. Security is tight, and choppers buzz overhead. Not everyone has been given their allotted food or the promised cash of 25,000 rupees, about $300. Without it, people are reluctant to go back. A young bearded man named Anwar Ali sorts through the holdouts. You're not going back if you don't get anything, right? So you are refusing, he says to one man. Ali sounds abrupt, but passes no judgment on those who decline to return home without some cash. Residents go back to a ravaged economy in Swat. 25-year-old Akhtar Muhammad is a father of one who's not going anywhere. We can't trust them, he says. If the government hasn't given us resources here, where the situation is normal, how can I trust them to give it to us in the middle of that confusion back home? Ashad Hussein recently returned to Swat to scout whether he could go back permanently. He will, but his trip provided a glimpse into the precarious security back home. The other day, he says, the army was telling the police not to flee and to help normalize the situation. Fears of a security vacuum have many adopting a wait-and-see attitude. For those who do go back, the homecoming is bittersweet. While smiling children wave from the buses, their parents sit subdued. 2 months in a sweltering camp, contending with their upended lives, has taken its toll. And the days ahead, back in the valley they call home, are filled with uncertainty. Julie McCarthy, NPR News.
It's 2:46. 6 years ago, President Bush proposed to end our addiction to oil by building a hydrogen economy. At the time, driving a hydrogen-powered car didn't seem that far off. But today, the reality of mass-produced hydrogen-powered cars has hit some bumps in the road. Mark Brush looks at the challenges ahead.
It all starts with the fuel cell. The cell converts hydrogen gas into electricity that can power up a motor. And when that's done, the only thing that comes out of the tailpipe is crystal clean water. So there's a lot of enthusiasm to build hydrogen-powered cars. If you live in Southern California, you can drive one of these cars right now.
What if there were a car that didn't use gasoline? Introducing the FCX Clarity fuel cell vehicle from Honda.
But you can't buy this car. You can only lease it. And you have to have a pretty good map. There are only 2 places where you can fill the car up with hydrogen. And that highlights just one of the challenges facing the hydrogen car right now. There's no infrastructure, no network of gas stations to support it. Stephen Chu heads up the Obama administration's Department of Energy.
It's an infrastructure that has to be as extensive as the infrastructure for gasoline and diesel. So that doesn't come overnight.
Chu wants to eliminate all the research money for hydrogen-powered cars and trucks. He says there are too many big problems to solve. There's the infrastructure problem. Fuel cells are expensive. The cheapest way to make hydrogen right now releases pollution, and there are problems with storing the gas. In an interview with MIT's Technology Review, Energy Secretary Chu referred to these problems as the 4 miracles, and that didn't sit too well with some people.
A miracle? Really? How many miracles have you seen? I'm not sure I've seen a real miracle in my life.
Levi Thompson directs the Hydrogen Energy Technology Laboratory at the University of Michigan. He says talking about these problems as miracles sends the wrong message. He admits there are some big puzzles to solve, but he's convinced that scientists can solve them.
If you believe this is the savior, so to speak, this is going to transform the way we do things, I think you have a responsibility to invest, even though you see that it's far behind.
Thompson says the ultimate goal for a hydrogen economy is to get the hydrogen from water, using electricity from renewable resources like wind, solar, and hydropower. So you get the clean-burning gas you're looking for. It can be done today, but it's expensive. Thompson thinks it'll get cheaper as alternative sources of electricity become more widespread. The Energy Department doesn't want to give up on hydrogen research altogether. Secretary Chu says fuel cells do make sense on a small scale, like to power forklifts in a warehouse. Here at the Cisco warehouse in Grand Rapids, Michigan, a mini hydrogen experiment is underway. Cisco is a major food distributor. This warehouse is part of a year-long government-funded project. They're running 17 of their forklifts using hydrogen-powered fuel cells made by a company called Plug Power. Darren Van Dyne is with Cisco. He says mostly they've had a good experience with these fuel cells.
We've had about 80 hours of lost time due to repair. Minor failures, things like that, but nothing major has disrupted our operation.
Van Dyne says the company hasn't decided yet if they'll move forward with the fuel cell program. But some policymakers say real-world experiments like these move us closer to mass-produced hydrogen vehicles. Even though the Obama administration wants to cut funding for hydrogen-powered cars and trucks, Congress holds the purse and has the final say. So far, it looks like Congress will continue to fully fund the research. And automakers say the ups and downs of federal funding don't affect their plans. Several companies say they'll start selling hydrogen-powered cars in 6 to 8 years, and they'll let the market decide the fate of the hydrogen economy. For the Environment Report, I'm Mark Brush.
NASA has technology light years ahead of what's available to the rest of us. Advanced water recycling is one of them. For years, astronauts have collected and recycled sweat and even water vapor. Sean Ali looks at NASA's latest water recycling technology and whether anything like it exists on planet Earth.
A press conference between NASA headquarters and the International Space Station got some attention recently. It was about making drinkable water from astronauts' urine.
The Expedition 19 crew inaugurating the use of the water recovery system to produce recycled, purified water.
NASA figures sending water into space wastes rocket fuel. Why pay good money if you can just reuse water that comes out of astronauts' bodies? Astronauts have recycled other fluid, but urine was kind of the final frontier.
Everybody's talked about recycling water in a closed-loop system, but nobody's ever done it before. So we're going to be drinking yesterday's coffee, I think, frequently up here, and happy to do it.
Three astronauts hold up their drink pouches.
And here we go, and here's to everybody who made this all happen.
Cheers! That looks really, really good from down here. We just wanted to say,
for all the jokes cracked in space, water is a pretty serious problem here on Earth. Is anyone recycling urine like they are on the space station? Well, it depends on how you cut it. NASA's system is a closed loop. It's water out, urine in, water out. Similar technology is used during some natural disasters, and the country of Singapore gets pretty darn close. Singapore recycles sewage water, but it's sent to reservoirs where it's diluted. So how far does America get with recycled water? Public service announcements hint at who's furthest along.
Southern California is getting drier. Go to BeWaterWise.com. Find out how your community is dealing with mandatory conservation.
For decades, California utilities have used recycled wastewater to spruce up landscaping and golf courses, but you're not allowed to drink it. Orange County goes a tad further. It replenishes an underground aquifer with recycled water. The utility draws water out of that aquifer. So it's a kind of water recycling, more like Singapore's diluted variety than NASA's fully closed loop. According to the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, no city in America has astronaut-style water recycling. But some water utility managers predict some city will.
It is absolutely a non-issue from a perception standpoint, and purely from a perception. Oh, my God, you're making me drink toilet water. You know, get over it, because you've been doing it all along anyhow.
That's Frank Yeager. He runs the water system in Parker, a Denver suburb. Yeager says most water systems are more like Singapore's and Orange County's than you might think.
I was in New Orleans, and I had the chance to go through their treatment process, and they pointed out that 10 years in a row they had won the drinking water award for turbidity, taste, odor, and that water coming down the Mississippi had, by estimate, been through 12 stomachs by the time it got to New Orleans. They drink it with a little more scotch than we do, but they drink it.
Yeager says, think of the advantages a full water recycling system would have. Some cities would save energy since they'd pump water shorter distances. And you'd get a consistent supply of water since you can count on people bathing and flushing on a regular basis.
It is silly in this day and age to be worried about those types of things, especially here in the United States where we have such wonderful treatment process.
There's no federal regulation that specifically prohibits full toilet-to-tap water recycling. So Yeager says someday some politically brave local government will move forward. Just not his. For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Ali.
California's budget crisis could mean unprecedented cuts in health and social services. What does that mean for low-income families who rely on several of those programs?
It has interfered with my sleep. It's just an overwhelming chess game that you're playing in your mind.
That story later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Coming up on The World at 3 o'clock this afternoon, 2001 marked the end of Taliban rule in Afghanistan. But its leaders and fighters have regrouped. They now control vast areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Their influence continues to grow, and that's a major concern for the governments of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the United States. The resurgence of the Taliban, that's during the day's news coming up today on The World at 3 o'clock here on AM 580. AM 580 brings you NPR's daily wrap-up of the Sotomayor confirmation hearings each evening at 10. And, of course, we'll keep you updated throughout the day on our news programs. You can also watch the News Hour's live coverage of the hearings during the day on WILL-TV's digital channel 12.2 or streamed live on our website, will.illinois.edu.
Earth and Sky.
In Africa, we have a special concern about abrupt climate change, because we know from the records of past climate that it's possible for climate to change abruptly in this region.
You're listening to atmospheric scientist Carrie Cook. Dr. Cook specializes in the study of abrupt climate change, the kind of change that might rapidly transform a landscape over decades as opposed to centuries.
None of the climate models are indicating yet abrupt climate change for Africa, for the near future. But we don't have huge confidence in our ability of the climate models for prediction over Africa.
Cook said that's due to a combination of Africa's complicated climate system and a lack of observational records.
You need to have observing systems in place for longer periods of time, for say 50, 60, 70 years, and we simply have not had that for Africa.
Cook's climate models predict that by the end of the 21st century, Africans will experience more hardship due to increased temperatures, droughts, and flooding. If these climate changes come abruptly, she worries that the continent will be left with little time to mitigate the impact. I'm Lindsay Patterson. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta is now open in their new location at Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
Half of the world's people now live in cities. 2 billion more will join them over the next 25 years. Next time on our morning show, Focus 580, we'll look at what these trends mean for cities and the people who live in them. Our guest will be Jeb Brugman, author of Welcome to the Urban Revolution. The book argues that the 21st century's greatest challenges must be met through improved approaches to city building. It shows how cities can be transformed into more productive and sustainable places. I'm David Inge, Focus 580 at 11.
It's 2 minutes before 3 o'clock. This